inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. If you're just tuning in, this is The Lynn Show, coming to you on the Radio Ear Network at 1 o'clock on Tuesday. I always get into this thing about the times. I don't know why that is. You certainly know whatever time it is that you're listening. If you've been listening, well, I want to thank you. And if you have been listening, then you almost certainly know that this is, I think, show number 12 or 13 of the series, and this would make it the 12th or 13th show that I have ever done. And if you've been listening since the beginning in January, you know that I'm evolving as a radio show host and am new at it and creating this thing pretty much as I go along. And I have been curious, as I have not really known whether anyone was listening. They told me at the beginning that 30 people listened to the first show and 31 people listened to the second show, which I thought was good. And that was in January. And so I pretty much figured nobody much was listening. And then I got the stats for February. I'm so funny. I thought actually it was the stats for January and February, but it was just for February, and 1,190 people listened. So, wow. Okay, good. And I just got the stats for March, and apparently 2,561 people listened in March. Now, I have no way of knowing whether the 2,561 of you that listened in March are, you know, 1,190 of you are still listening from February, or somehow a completely new group of people found me in March, and here we're almost done with April. Actually, when you hear this show, it'll probably be May, because I pre-record all these shows, and they don't get aired until after I've recorded them. But then I will know by then whether any of you listened in April. Anyway, it's both exciting and a little terrifying to me to know that somebody is listening out there beside my friends Max and Joyce and Ruth. Hello, Max and Joyce and Ruth. And to the rest of you, hello. And I'd really like to hear from you. I know I say every week that you can email me. Nobody ever does, which is part of the reason that I thought no one was listening, because nobody emails me. But if you would, that would be terrific. If you're listening, you know, I mean, if you've been listening to some, many, all of the shows, I'd really like to hear what you liked about them, what you'd like me to do more of. I am evolving this. It is not in stone or cement or even wet cement. It's really becoming. And again, if you've been listening, you know that I have begun to do a series of interviews with artists labeled Anatomy of an Artist. And this, of course, is so close to my heart because I am a singer-songwriter, a writer, and because as a psychotherapist, when I was practicing in Los Angeles, which I am only doing now by telephone, my entire practice was writers and artists. And I started the Writers and Artists Institute in Los Angeles to address the emotional needs of that population of which I am a part. I realized after I started to practicing in California that there's no particular training for treating the artist. At least there wasn't in where I went to school, and I don't think there really is. You know, they treat for all kinds of conditions, but they don't treat for the condition of being an artist. And being an artist in this culture is really problematic. I mean, if I didn't know from my own life, I certainly heard over and over again from the people in my practice. Commonly, we are encouraged as kids to develop our artistic talent. Oh, she sings, she dances, he draws, he writes. Oh, they put on a play. Oh, they got into the school play. Oh, they play an instrument, and oh, they're in the band, and yay. And we're encouraged in that way, most of us, many of us. And it's wonderful, you know, if you come into the world with an artistic passion, you discover a color, you discover words, you discover music, and you want to be in it, you want to be of it, you want to be it. And you get this encouragement from your family, from your friends, from your school. So you be it, do it. But soon enough, the world starts to not like it, discourage it. Yeah, but really, but what are you going to do for a living? You know, how are you going to survive? How are you going to support yourself? And while that's a terrible thing to do to a budding artist, I certainly understand why parents and teachers and friends do it. It's because this culture makes very, very little space for artists. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, whether you're an artist or not. You know that a tiny percentage, I think 6% or something, of the people who are in Screen Actors Guild or Equity actually make a living. So what does that mean? 96% are doing this for next to nothing. And, you know, the statistics are the same for dancers and fine artists and photographers. And I heard a documentary once. I've forgotten her name. I'm so sorry. It was done on a orchestra conductor, a woman. And, of course, you know, conducting, you know, there are 10 conducting jobs in the world. I don't know, maybe there are 100 conducting jobs in the world. So if what you wanted to be was a conductor, you know, your chances are really very, very tiny. And if you're a female, tinier still. And it was confided to me by a man who was a brilliant conductor. and heterosexual, that that also worked against you. Although maybe that's slander. And maybe that's not true, and maybe it's not true anymore. But it's probably still true that if you're a female conductor, your chances are not so hot. And she was saying something that hadn't occurred to me but was clearly true, and that was that if you're a conductor, you can't do what you do without an orchestra. You know, if you're a singer, you can sing in the shower if you need to. If you're a writer, obviously, you can do it on your own. Actors can be in classes. There are lots of places for that kind of expression, but if you're a conductor, good luck to you if you don't get a job. You can stand in your house and, you know, wave your baton at the mirror, but that's about it. Anyway, it's tough to have fallen in love with a creative art and wanted to make your living at it. I treated a lot of people who wound up in advertising because they'd fallen in love with drawing or writing and found that advertising was almost the only place that they could make a living doing that thing that they loved, although it was not doing it in the way that they had wanted to. And that's a price. So, oh, the poor artist. Well, you know what? It really is painful. So I have begun to do a series of interviews with people who have tried to and have made their living doing their art. And I hope that you're as interested in it as I am. And as I have said before, if you're an artist and you're making your living dancing, singing, writing, directing, acting, and you want to be interviewed, I would like to hear from you. So you can email me at Lynn Bernfield, that's LynnBernfield, one word, LynnBernfield@gmail.com. Or you can go up on my website, which is The Lynn Show, and that's LynnE, because I noticed that there's a Lynn, LYNN, who also has a website called The Lynn Show. Who would have thought? But no, mine is LynnE, thelynnshow.com. When I was a kid, they also spelled my name LYNN. And when I was 16, I decided that LYNN not only actually was a boy's name, it is actually a boy's name. Those of you who know who Lynn Swan is will know. But not only was it actually a boy's name, but it didn't look feminine to me. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make that look feminine and decided that all I could do was add an E to the end. So that's me, Lynn, at The Lynn Show. And you can go up on the website and you can find my book there and my CD there and the radio show, and you can download the article that I've written on phone therapy if you're interested in that. Can find out how to contact me, how to hire me as a consultant for your company, or just to write to me. So, okay, in this show, and continuingly, I've been talking about the topic in my book, Why People Can't Always Make the Changes in Their Life That They Want To, the book, When You Can, You Will. And today I will be continuing. I'm going to do a little recap for those of you who haven't been listening. Oh, and by the way, on the website, you can also download the podcasts of previous shows. So if I talk about something that I have actually explained in detail in an earlier show and you want to hear that, you can download it from there. So I'm going to do a little recap on modeling and anti-modeling, which is what the last two shows were about, and move on to the topic of the cover story. Much as secret agents, we all have cover stories. So I'm going to talk about that in a little while, and then I'm going to interview Sharon Leslie. At this point, we're talking about how who you think you are influences what you think you can do. So in the last two shows, I was talking about modeling and anti-modeling. That is, who you patterned yourself after and who you decided you didn't want to be anything like. And of course, we've got our parents, so those are the choices that we have when we're little. We think that these are the ways a person can be in the world. We can be like this one, or we can be like that one. If you liked your parents of the same sex, if you admired them, if you felt loved by them, if your parents seemed to like and love each other, then the chances are good you modeled yourself after the parent of the same sex. And that, when all is said and done, is the most comfortable thing to do. If you didn't like the parent of the same sex, were embarrassed by them, neglected by them, thought that the other parent was more attractive or more interesting, then you might have anti-modeled the parent of the same sex and modeled the parent of the opposite sex. Having modeled or anti-modeled a parent, you then think of yourself as limited by the qualities that you identified with that parent. And today I want to talk about another way that we come to think of what is possible for us, what we are. And that I've labeled our cover story. And as I pointed out earlier, it's so much like secret agents. We all have cover stories. That is to say, they're what we present, what we think is going to work in the certain circumstances, but not the whole truth. Families have to have balance. And in order to get balance, they teach every child a particular role so that all the roles in the family are covered. The role which they teach you becomes your cover story. Everybody has a cover story. It's a detailed explanation of who you are and who you aren't. You create this cover story to satisfy what you think is your family's requirements. But because you base this cover story on who you believe your family wants you to be and not on who you actually are, it isn't strictly accurate. In your cover story, you admit to having certain qualities while you deny others. The qualities that you acknowledge, your cover, they are qualities that you can use. The qualities that you deny go undercover and become unavailable to you. This story generally works quite well in your family, and as long as the changes you want to make require you only to use cover traits, well, then you can usually make them quite easily. But when what you want to do requires you to expose a trait you have hidden undercover, you can get stuck. And in fact, one of the things that mostly gets between us and the changes that we want to make is our reluctance to having to blow our cover. All children are sensitive to the needs of their parents, and with really startling flexibility, we can all quickly figure out what pleases and what displeases our parents. And then we learn to do whatever is necessary. So we will act smart or dumb or sick or well or responsible or incompetent as required. Beyond growing up, children only have one goal, and that's to be the child their parent wants them to be. Your cover is designed to protect you by convincing your parents that you are the child they want, or by helping you fit into your particular family structure. Children believe, and rightly so, that their lives depend on creating the perfect cover and hiding whatever they believe is undesirable about themselves, whatever it is that their parent wouldn't want or doesn't think they are, hiding that safely under cover. Sadly, sometimes parents prefer inadequate children because they enjoy the feeling of personal power that they get from the dependence of their children. Feeling inadequate themselves, lots of parents can experience the emerging strength of their children as a threat. So parents who need children to be sick or dumb or sloppy or incompetent find ways to make this known. And messages about who the child had better be or better not be are clearly, if often non-verbally, communicated. And children are in very little doubt as to what is expected of them. So however you experienced the world as a child, whoever you were told you were, or whoever you decided you had to be, that became your cover. And you retain it to this day. If you were born to parents who didn't want children, well, then you might see yourself as an intruder. Or if your parents had tried and tried and tried and then finally had you, then you might feel very special. There are as many possible covers as there are situations to create them. Your cover could be that you're inadequate, or lucky, or fragile, that you're a winner or a loser, that you're the one who's saved or the one who's abandoned. Once you've decided on your cover, it becomes the way you not only think of yourself, but the way you present yourself to the world. Without saying a word, you announce, I'm pretty, I'm ugly, I'm interesting, or I'm dull. Pay attention to me. Ignore me. Take care of me, or watch out for me. I'm a bully. I'm a victim. I'm the audience, or I'm the star. Your cover is so convincing that you act as if it's true, even if it isn't true. For example, if your cover is, I try, but I don't succeed, although you really have the ability to succeed, you rarely do. You somehow get in the way of that. I have had many, many clients who present themselves in ways that are just completely wrong. I've had pretty clients who think they're ugly and brave men who think they're cowards. I've had people with a lot of talent and intelligence present themselves as though they're inadequate. Remember that the cover story was created in order to fit into your family. It's not the whole truth of you. So how does having a cover story that's not the whole truth about you affect what you're able to do in your life? Well, obviously, if you think you're a coward, there are things that you won't risk, even if you have the inner fortitude to risk them. If you think you're incompetent, not only might you not try things that you could actually do, but you'll present as incompetent in situations where if you actually got the job or the activity, you could really do it. But then there are even more subtle ways. I'm thinking about a young man who came to see me. There was something he wanted badly to do, and he really couldn't make himself do it. And the details don't actually matter. This was a young black man who came from a very, very tight-knit family. Grandparents, parents, siblings, a very, very tight unit. And all of the people in the system were encouraged to honor what they came to think of as loyalty. And this particular young man was assigned the job of the most loyal in the system. He had siblings who were not quite so loyal, and they came in for a lot of flack from the system. But he always honored the family's traditions. And what he wanted to do would require him to not honor a family tradition. And talk about a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, he had this thing which really seemed to be essential to his well-being, happiness, and satisfaction in life. And on the other hand, if he did it, it meant that he was not loyal. And loyalty was his cover story. It was what got him the affection, the concern, the good feeling, the place in his family. Perhaps you can begin to ask yourself, what is it that I want to do that I'm not able to do? And do I have a cover story that gets in the way of what I want to do? Right now, I'm going to play a song, Send in the Clowns, actually, recorded by Sharon Leslie, who is my guest. And then I'm going to play part of her interview, because it was so long, I'm going to have to play the next part next week. Okay, coming up now is Send in the Clowns. Isn't it bliss?
one who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clouds? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours. Timing my entrance again with my usual flair, sure of my lines. My fault, I fear. I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear. But where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns.
Continuing the series Anatomy of an Artist, I am here with the incredibly multi-talented Sharon Leslie. I was thinking, actually, before we did this, of all of the things that you do. And I was thinking, well, I'll say she's an actor, and she's a songwriter, and she's a lyricist, and she's a singer, and she's a director, and she's a playwright, and she's
a teacher.
And she's a teacher, right.
And a mom.
And a mom, yes. And a producer.
Yes.
And a costume.
Yes, I can do that too.
Right. So why don't we start out with you just talking a little bit about how you came to this, what the early, your early experiences were like, what you made you want to do any of this, and where it started, and what you thought you wanted to do.
Well, when I grew up in a suburb of Louisville, Kentucky called Anchorage. And Anchorage is a very interesting suburb at the time because there were some women who had gotten together years before my family moved there, and they created what was known as the Anchorage Children's Theater Press. So there was a lot of children's theater going on in Anchorage. I grew up, I remember doing my first big show, Alice in Wonderland, and fourth grade, and this was children's theater that was done by children for children rather than by adults for children.
Yeah.
So we would all audition, and I remember my first big audition, I got a call back to be considered as Alice.
Oh my gosh.
In Alice in Wonderland. I was shocked. My mother was flabbergasted. My sisters were jealous. I really think I was too young to handle that role. It went to someone in the sixth grade. But it was a wonderful experience. And from then on, I just started doing lots of different children's theater all the way through high school. I did original music in two of the shows that were written by ladies in the area. So that kind of got me into doing original work. I went off to college, didn't do theater for 2 years, found I was missing it horribly. My soul was dying. So I went back to the University of Louisville and got my degree in the theater.
What made you go to that first audition? Was it your idea? Was it your mom's?
I think it was my mother's idea.
Wow.
But I was already getting solos in kindergarten.
Singing.
Singing.
Yes, solo singing. Yes.
So I had been doing a lot of, solo work, and I'd been sort of singled out once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
to do these things.
Right.
And so when we went to the audition, it was really three of my sisters, two of my sisters, and myself.
Oh, you all auditioned.
I got to audition. My younger sister did not. And my two older sisters auditioned. So one of them ended up playing the Queen of Hearts, the off-with-her-head part. And the other one didn't get a very big part. And I didn't end up with a very big part, but at least I got the call back.
Yeah. Well, okay, so now you're out of college, and?
Well, let's go back a little bit.
Okay.
As I'm in college, I've done a lot of performing, and I always thought I wanted to be a singer. In fact, I remember telling my mother before I even started college that I wanted to be a singer. And she looked at me, and she says, oh, what kind of singer? I said, well, you know, I think I'd like to play Las Vegas. And she looked at me like I was horrifying, that just that kind of ambition was just not the kind of thing you did. So I did take some of the entrance audition type stuff. And I got scared off of that kind of a major because I didn't have, even though I played the piano, I didn't have the music theory background and all that stuff. So I thought, I think I'm getting in over my head. So I didn't do it. And then when I actually married my first husband and then went back to college, and it was either become an engineer or go into the theater.
Oh, my goodness.
And guess what? Although I do have the engineering gene, which runs in my family, which helps me in many ways in this artistic field.
It might have been different if your mother had encouraged you.
Oh, it would have been.
It's so difficult to do something that you think is over your head. That's really difficult to do, but it's really hard if people have been telling you, are you crazy? You know, if they're saying you can do it and we have faith in you, then maybe...
Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. No, I never got that from either of my parents, which was too bad because I was, I mean, since we're talking about me, I was actually very athletically gifted, and I was a springboard diver.
Wow.
My father played professional baseball, semi-professional, I think, basketball, played football. He was a marvelous athlete. But my mother never encouraged my athletic ambitions because I remember her once saying, women with muscles are ugly. So she didn't encourage me in the two areas that I really had tremendous gifts in, sports or in singing and performing.
Yeah. I know that Sharon has an incredibly talented daughter whom she has been supporting and who is breaking out really as we speak.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's very rare. It's rare, I think, to have a parent encourage you in the arts.
Actually, that's changing.
Yeah?
That is changing. I think you're getting more encouragement of parents of kids in the arts. Mostly because I think they see how much money is, can possibly be made.
Well, okay, so now where are we?
We were getting me, either I was going to become an engineer or...
going to theater.
Yes. Yeah, I always did well in the sciences and math and chemistry and all those kinds of things. But I just couldn't see myself doing that for the rest of my life. So I loved the theater, and since I was married at the time, I thought, well, I don't need to worry about making money all the time.
Right.
So, sure, let's go into the theater. And not only let's go into the theater, since we're not worried about making money, we're not going to go into the educational aspect of the theater. We're not going to go and have the fallback, oh, well, you can always become an elementary school teacher and do it on the side. Oh, no. I made sure that it was my full profession because I did not wish to make that choice. And that forced me into not taking the side routes to keep after it just to keep after it as best I could.
You know, it's interesting because I know you so well. What I know is that you're a very dramatic person.
Oh, am I?
Yes, you are. Yeah, you are. And, I mean, it's such a natural fit for you. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine you as an engineer, actually. I mean, I know you can do all those things, but there's a flamboyance about you, you know, that's just true.
Yeah.
And so the theater really fits you in a way that teaching, well, I mean, I suppose you'd have been everybody's favorite teacher, but... You know, it would have required all kinds. I'm making motions that you can't see about restriction. You know,
that's it. That's the restriction part. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I do teach, and I have the greatest respect for teachers, but I just knew that I didn't feel I could fit in there. And interestingly enough, as my life progressed, every time I went into a professional situation that I had to go to work X amount of days for X amount of hours, I could last 6 to 9 months in that situation. If it was full-time, certainly much longer if it was more of a part-time situation. I'm just not happy. Mm-hmm. I can't be happy with that kind of lifestyle, yeah. Which is unfortunate because it'd be a lot easier if I could be happy in that lifestyle. But it just doesn't.
No, it doesn't fit.
It doesn't fit.
I know. And I think that that is true of a lot of creative people. You know, creative people are inhibited, that's not the right word, by restriction. You know, creativity demands a certain amount of flexibility and a certain amount of spontaneity and a certain amount of freedom.
Yes.
And the more restrictive the circumstance is, the less you can access that thing. And a creative person will feel that. They'll feel, stopped up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like your person, who you are, is being threatened.
Yes.
I can't do it.
Yeah.
And I as money goes up and down, mm-hmm. sometimes I go, okay, now I need to go get a job. I need to go do something. And then I find ways that I don't have to.
No, my God, you are so inventive. No.
I try every way I can to make money in manners that do not give me a time clock.
Yeah. Right.
Daily time clock situation.
It's so funny. I mean, it's the good news and the bad news to be a creative person.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
This culture does not really have room for creative people, people who don't fit into some mold, you know, some pigeonhole.
Except.
Yes.
The older I get, mm-hmm. and the more I'm in contact with, like, people who have retired or people who have done that life,
yes.
the more they express that they are envious of our lifestyle.
Oh, I don't question that for a minute.
Which always shocks me.
Oh, no,
I go,
no.
What's wrong with them? Don't they know that this is hard?
How hard is
that easy? Don't they get that this, you know, it's much easier to go to a job and just have somebody else take care of things? And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That is the trade-off. See, that's the trade-off, is that you get to own your time. You get to own your life. But it's scary, and it's undependable, and you never know. You know, it's a feast and famine.
Absolutely.
And most people are not willing to make that trade-off.
Yes. But I got to tell you that when our kids were growing up, they weren't too happy with our lifestyle, particularly our oldest son. He just didn't get that we didn't go out and have jobs. And because all of his friends' parents did that, and, you know, but now that they're all in their 20s, mm-hmm. we have three kids. Our oldest is 26, our boy, Robert. We've got a daughter, 25, Catherine. And our youngest is graduating from college as an engineer, architectural and civil, this Maine. So he's 22. And all of them look at us now that they've gone out and had regular jobs like, boy, our parents, they're doing something that I think I want to do, mm-hmm. because they're not really happy in the workplace the way
kids.
It is. And, well, they are our kids, but our son came home this year, our youngest son, from college for a winter break. And, you know, we're not rolling in dough. But I think I just created the lyric that says, our lives are rich without much money. and my husband was saying, well, you know, we don't have money to do this. And we're, you know, we don't have a lot of money. And our son said, wait a minute. I want you to examine this for a second. You have no idea how wealthy you are because you own your time. Do you know how rare it is to own your own time? And that is, if you really wanted to discuss the nature of wealth, if it goes beyond just considering, and it does, it goes beyond just considering how much money you have in the bank, because you could have millions in the bank and be incredibly unhappy because you don't own your life.
That's right.
But we do own our lives.
No, and it is a trade-off. It's a trade-off for most of us. There's that tiny percentage of the arts population who are making lots of money, and you know, but for most working artists, you know, we're struggling. You know, sometimes we have it, and sometimes we don't, and sometimes we have to do stuff we don't want to do
right.
in order to survive.
Right, and raise kids.
And raise kids, exactly, exactly.
The trade-off is, okay, well, we don't have millions in the bank.
Well, okay, I want you to talk about, I want you to talk a little bit about all of the things you've done.
I know.
But one of the things I think that people who are not artists don't realize is how, you know, I introduced you as the multi-talented, and you are, and a lot of artists are, that is, that they wind up doing a lot of different things. I'm still thinking in pigeonhole, you know, we got the fine artist, and we got the performer, and we got the dancer, and we got the director, but it's really
not true.
People are crossing these boundaries and these lines all over the place. So I think it would be really lovely if you just talked a little bit about your singing career, and a little bit about your writing, and a little bit about the opera, and a little bit about directing, and...
Okay, well, actually, I went to school thinking I was going to be a director, because I have a talent for directing. I haven't really pursued that as much as I might have liked, because of children, etc. But I'm a master's degree dropout in directing, and that's the direction I thought that my career would take. Well, when I left my first husband and moved to Florida, started getting hired and cast in all kinds of singing positions, which takes me back to my original ambition to be a singer. So I was cast in operettas. I did tours of The Merry Widow and was a waitress, and I worked at a bakery, and I, what else did I do? Oh my God, I can't remember what else I've done.
It's okay. It doesn't matter.
Oh, I know. And I worked for a construction company, and I worked in box offices and all kinds of different jobs to keep the money coming in while I'm doing my art thing. And then I met David, and we got married, and he's a pianist. We never married with the intention of performing together, but after we had two children, someone said, well, why don't you do a concert together? So we did a concert together, and we made money. And we thought, oh, well, this is interesting. So we started pursuing and doing concert work together. And in the midst of doing that, David's a great arranger, so we would sit home and we would create these special musical presentations of songs that everybody knew, but they would sound differently. Mm-hmm. And so we did all that concert work.
I wanted you to talk about the concert career with David, because I didn't realize that that wasn't always your plan. Because when I met you, you were doing that.
Right.
And we've never talked about this, so I didn't know that this was sort of a happenstance thing.
It was a happenstance thing, mm-hmm. and it was a way, I always call it the most amount of money for the least amount of time out of the house. So as a mother, David and I could rehearse almost any time. Of course, the kids eventually started calling us much too noisy because we'd be practicing while they were home and making, you know, noise, but that's the way it goes. We had an agent in Toronto. We played the Canadian National Exhibition. We were featured at the Plaza Hotel when it was there. David played all the four-star hotels up there himself as solo pianist.
I'm sorry to have so abruptly interrupted my interview with Sharon. There was not, in my view, a perfect place to stop. So I stopped it there because at the end of the show I'm going to play a piano solo piece by David, Sharon's husband. I'm going to play Rhapsody in Blue. Well, actually, I'm going to play the last 6 minutes of Rhapsody in Blue. And so I ended the interview with Sharon talking about David as a solo pianist. I'm going to pick this interview up next week, and you can hear the rest of it then. Now, before I play David Orenstein playing 6 minutes of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, I want to wrap up what I was talking about earlier about cover story. And what I want to say is maybe you've been thinking about what it is that you want to do that you might not be able to do, and what might be in your cover story that might be stopping you. So these are two separate issues, of course, the what I want to do that I can't do, and that is the focus of all of the things I talk about in the shows, trying to find what it is that's getting between you and what you want to do. And one of the most significant things, I think everything, all the things that I indicate are significant. And of course, if they're the thing that's getting between you and what you want to do, they are the most significant. So as it concerns the cover story, your idea of yourself is so important to what you think is possible for you to do. And of course, so as a man thinketh, how does that go? As a man thinketh, so he doeth or don't doeth. So the real question is, how do you think about yourself? What do you think you are and you're not? I give this exercise in my workshops. It's in the book. It's in the workbook. By the way, you can get the workbook also. You can just download the workbook from my website. But the exercise is, who are you? You just make a list. I am these things, and I am not those things. I am kind. I am frugal. I am anxious. I am aggressive. I am passive. I am timid. I am not timid. Just begin to think about the things that you think about yourself. Just look at them on a page. And of course, you can look at your family pie. And in one of the earlier shows, I described at length the family pie exercise. And you can look at your family pie, and you can look at the things that you have listed in your pie piece. And of course, those are the things you think you are. And look at the things that you listed in the pie pieces of your other family members. And if they don't also exist in your pie piece, then you also don't think they are true of you. The things in your pie piece, they are your cover story. Well, at least part of your cover story, since most of us can't get everything down. Look at that. Look at what you've said about yourself. Look at what you think about yourself. And see if what you want to do requires something that doesn't show up in your pie piece. And maybe even more importantly, and I will speak about this ongoingly, does what you want to do require a quality that shows up in a pie piece of another member of your family? Pay attention. That's very important. Okay, so enough about the cover story, enough about change. Now I'm going to play David Ornstein playing that extraordinary piece of music, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and as I have said many, many times today, only the last 6 minutes. I couldn't play the whole 13 or 14 minutes, but it's so beautiful. And here it is. Thank you. And that was David Arnstein playing the last 6 minutes of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And if you want to hear the rest of it, you can get the CD that it comes from. It's O Gershwin, a combination of obviously Gershwin songs sung by Sharon and played by David. And you can get a copy of that by going up on their website, LeslieandOrenstein.com. I'm going to spell all that. It's LeslieandOrenstein, one word, LeslieandOrenstein.com. And if you go up on their website, you can listen to pieces of all of their work, our Golda, Elizabeth of Russia, and Octavian and Cleopatra. And you can get the CDs from which I have played pieces while I was interviewing Sharon. Or if you haven't written down LeslieandOrenstein.com, you can go to my website, thelinshow.com, or you can email me, lynnburnfield@gmail.com. Before I close the show, I want to say again, thank you to my IT guy, Josh Hackney, without whom none of this would be possible. And to tell you once again that if you are in need of any internet, electronic, recording help, you could not do better than Josh. I'm fond of saying that he's young enough to know how all of this works and old enough to know the value of customer service. And you can get in touch with Josh. I'm going to give you his information, but of course you can always contact me and I will let him know you want to get in touch with him. So his telephone number is 941-320-7590. And his email address is Josh, J-O-S-H, C, the letter C, Hackney, H-A-C-K-N-E-Y, at yahoo.com. And of course, that's Josh C. Hackney, one word, just like it's lynnburnfield@gmail.com, one word. So next week, I'll probably do a recap on Cover Story in case whoever was listening last week wasn't listening this week. And then I'm going to move on to talk about undercover, those qualities which don't show up in your cover story, and explain how it comes to be that some things that we're in denial for. And of course, it's fairly self-obvious, I think, that things for which we are in denial for, very many fours, things for which we are in denial for, we don't have much access to them. And if we haven't got access to them, we can't use them. And so I'm going to talk about that, the whole issue of cover versus undercover. And I hope that you'll be here for that. Please stay tuned. There's wonderful stuff following us today. And I guess I just want to tell you that this is Lynn of The Lynn Show. And I will be here again next Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on the Radio Ear Network. And I really hope that you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Thank you. my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to